Moshe glows after we make a mistake. And we fix it. I've seen pictures. I've never been to Rome, but I've seen pictures of Michelangelo's statue, and to me it reminds me of Narnia. I mean, he looks like a goat man. Okay. He's got little horns. Those who say that he was trying to depict radiance, well, he should have put them on his face, because that's where the radiance was coming from. What are they doing up here? But apparently Michelangelo loved that statue. He thought it was going to talk to him. Be that as it may, this is the source of a lot of confusion. And everything else about that statue is amazing. So, who knows? But that's where it comes from. Look at text 9 on page 16 very briefly. Constance?
9 and 16, very briefly. The spiritual heights achieved by those who repent cannot be attained even by those who are perfectly righteous.
Right? Repenting, meaning you have first failed, you have first made a mistake, and then you have fixed it, is better than to never have failed at all.
Interesting, wouldn't have tried.
So the mistake and then the repentance brings about the glow. Quick question. Mordechai and Esther, right? Heroes of the Purim story. Esther was Mordechai's...
Secretary.
Secretary. Esther was Mordechai's first cousin. The Megillah clearly says she was the daughter of his uncle. And even I, in my high school math, can figure that out. The daughter of his uncle is his cousin. Okay, let's take a few minutes now to look at a very important misconception. When I say important misconception, I mean because, you want to fight about the apple? Fine about the apple. Moses had horns, he had horns. It doesn't change things one way or another. But when it comes to Torah law, here, mistranslations and misconceptions lead people to abandon the Torah altogether. Because if the Torah is somehow unethical, or simply non-understandable, then what purpose or what use is it? Therefore, here, the misconceptions and the mistranslations become dangerous. Very famous. The Torah clearly says, text 10a on page 16.
An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a hand for a hand, and a foot for a foot.
And what does that mean? That means if you hurt somebody's eye,
your eye.
If you hurt somebody's hand,
off with the hand.
Off with the hand. Okay. This is not what it means. This, in fact, according to Torah law, now listen to this and find out how closely this matches. This is 3,000 some odd years ago. How closely this matches modern court rulings. According to the Torah, the payment here, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, the payment for all the suffering, you have to pay damages, you have to pay for pain, you have to pay medical bills, you have to pay for lost work, and you have to pay for shame and humiliation.
Suffering.
Wow. Which we call emotional distress or whatever. That's what this means.
What do you know what comes next in the reading, in that chapter, excerpt, what comes next?
I don't know, off the top of my head, no.
I think something.
How do you know? See? Good question.
There's something there. I think this is something that there's or in that area that vengeance is mine, is the Lord.
It's not anywhere, but that's in the books of the prophets. But here, the word in Hebrew, how do you say eye for an eye in Hebrew, Rabbi? Ayin tachat ayin. Eye in lieu of an eye. Yad tachat yad. Hand in lieu of a hand. Although the Hebrew word tad literally means beneath or below. So replacement, right? This is the Torah's justice system. Now, you would have me believe, or somebody would have me believe, that the Torah once upon a time, even if we change it nowadays because we are, more ethical. So once upon a time, the Torah would have them poke out somebody's eye because he blinded somebody, or cut off his hand because he blinded somebody. First of all, even logically, it doesn't make sense. Because it's not even. An eye for an eye. It's not possible. The Torah, of course, doesn't say you poke out an eye if you poke out somebody's eye. An eye for an eye simply means you damage somebody's eye, your eye gets damaged. Really. So if you blind, if somebody blinds somebody else, two-thirds of the way.
Maybe just the punishment
must fit
the crime.
Yeah, so the punishment must fit the crime, then you cannot do to him what he did to somebody else. Different people have different pain, what do you call it, tolerance thing? You know, an actor losing an eye is very different from a garbage collector losing an eye. So there's no such thing as the punishment will be equal. That's first of all. Second of all, it's not even what Torah says.
Hearing the way he should be put to death, more so right. That, but I don't know how they do it, but right. He should take his hearing. Why? The hearing is more important than the eye.
Because in Hebrew, hearing is the same word as obeying.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, let's look at text 10c for. Can I skip one? Yes, 10b. 10b.
Let me
just
finish this so you can look later on the text.
Here, later on. Here we go. This is what the Torah tells you to do when somebody hurts somebody else. Text 10b reads, if men quarrel and one strikes the other with a stone or a fist and the victim does not die, what do we call that? Battery and assault, right? And he's confined to bed, but if the victim gets up and walks about outside unaided, in other words, he's not a murder victim, then the assailant shall be cleared. If he has only paid for income loss due to the victim's enforced idleness and his medical costs. None of this lining up against the wall and throwing a stone at him, or hitting him with a fist. In other words, if you believe in retaliation, here is nothing about retaliation. Not only that, the very phrase, an eye for an eye, or a hand for a hand, or a life for a life, is used in a compensation discussion. Look at text 10c. Text 10c reads, one who slays an animal that belongs to another shall pay for it. How does he pay for it? A life for a life. Has anybody believed that we were killing people for killing animals? Animal rights. Animal rights is a new thing.
The man that killed the animal, he had animals, and the other guy could kill his animal, not him.
No, he shall pay for it. Meaning he pays
for a life.
Right. He pays the value of the lost life. So the wording itself is used to mean compensation. Yes.
Again, I've always found it difficult to reconcile later on Parsha Maaseh at the end of the book of Numbers. It talks about unintentional manslaughter, then you have the Goel Adam, the victim's family can dispatch someone
right.
To go out and execute the murderer. The one who's guilty of manslaughter.
The almost murder, right. So suffice it to say, for the purposes of our discussion, that is outside of the court entirely. That's something that is completely a different story because it's not justice. This is talking about justice. In the justice system, there never was and there never will be such a thing as an eye for an eye in the most literal sense. And I take the most literal sense because here we have an example of what I have now chosen to, ever since I started learning this course and preparing for it, I now call it Amelia Bedelia Judaism, or Amelia Bedelia Torah Scholar. Well, who is Amelia Bedelia? Come on, Rachel, I need your help. She's in a children's book. And what is she famous for?
What do you think? Preschool for how many years?
Amelia Bedelia was a housekeeper who read the Bible, or her instructions, literally. So her boss told her to dress the chicken. She sewed a nice little pair of pants and a shirt. She dressed the chicken. And then her boss told her to put out the lights. So she put the light bulbs and she hung them out outside. And so on and so on. What did she do? She read it?
Literally.
The problem is that dress the chicken literally means put on spices. And put out the lights literally means turn it off. So what's the difference between literal and literal? The answer is you have to understand the context. You have to understand how language is used. And to say I'm reading it literally is not necessarily to read it literally. It's Amelia Bedelia literally. So somebody says, well, I read the Torah and it says an eye for an eye. Don't you start interpreting. No. That's Amelia Bedelia literal. Ayin tachat ayin, or in this case, a life for a life, means a compensation that is due for the loss of fill in the blank. We're left with the question, though, why then does the Torah choose to say it that way? Could have just as easily have said, a bank account in lieu of a life, check in lieu of an eye, and so on. And yet it uses the term ayin tachat ayin. What did I say about tachat? What does the word tachat mean literally? Literally, beneath. The human eye is stacked up immediately, directly beneath the divine eye. The human hand is symbolic of the divine hand. And this whole business of the Torah Every time the Torah says God saw, God spoke, God went, God lifted, God... These are all obviously anthropomorphisms that are not meant to be taken literally. God doesn't speak, God doesn't move, and so on. And yet, the Torah uses these words so that we can understand what we're talking about. So, however God communicates, we call that speaking, because that's what we do. However God takes notice, we call that seeing, because that's what we do. And that's what it means when the Torah says human being is in the image of God, which is a little tricky because God doesn't have an image. So the human being represents all of these characteristics of God. And therefore, ayin tachat ayin, you have struck a human being, whether it be in the eye or the hand or whatever it is. Do you realize what you have done? This is the image of God. How dare you strike a fellow human being? So the word ayin tachat ayin, or the structure of that sentence, is the message to the assailant. You're not just attacking another mammal. This is a human being who is tachat, right? Who is directly below the divine. And therefore, we need to be very careful in the way we treat our fellow human beings. Obviously, if there's more than one way to read it literally, then how do we know what's right? We've had this discussion in many other classes, and the short answer is the oral Torah. In other words, if you're going to have an interpretation anyway, let's stick with the original interpretation which came to us from Moses. There have been a great many challenges to this throughout history. Modern Jews are not the first. We had in the times of the temple, we had the Sadducees, followed by the Christians, followed by the Karaites 1,000 years ago, various groups that believed or at least accepted the written word, but rejected the oral Torah, and then of course wound up with very strange traditions because they wind up, who knows, maybe they did wind up poking people's eyes out. Or, for example, let's go straight to page 19. Assuming, by the way, this is a big assumption, assuming that you had the punctuation, which is this thing, from the Torah, and assuming that you had the vowels, which help you read the words, which is missing from the Torah, and assuming this is a valid translation. All right, three huge assumptions, but I'll grant you all of that. This is a very familiar paragraph, but assume for a moment, or pretend for a moment you didn't have a background in Judaism. Can you tell me what this paragraph says? Can you read it, please? This is the learning activity on page 19.
And these words that I command you this day shall be upon your heart. You shall teach them to your sons and speak of them when you sit in your house, when you walk on the way, when you lie down and when you rise up. And you shall bind them for a sign upon your hand, and they shall be there for
Totafot
between your eyes. And you shall inscribe them upon the doorposts of your house and upon your gates.
Well, there's at least one Hebrew word in there that can't be translated. There's no English word for it, and there's no similar Hebrew word for it, so we have no idea what it means. But besides Totafot, everything else was successfully translated into English. So now you know what it says. Therefore, you know what it means. So answer me this. What word shall be upon your heart? These words? How do you put words on your heart anyway? And you shall bind them on your hand? How and where does one bind these words onto one's hand? And even if I knew what Totafot are, where am I supposed to, how am I put them between my eyes? And what shall I write on my doorpost? I just punished my child for scribbling on the doorpost. Was he doing a mitzvah? This is the Shema, and we can make heads or tails of it without interpreting the additional information, which we call the oral Torah. So, a lot of, and indeed most of Judaism comes from the oral Torah. And therefore we find a lot of information in the oral Torah. Like, for example, you all know the story of Abraham being commanded to sacrifice his son, Isaac. How old was Isaac?
37 years old.
He wasn't this little child. He was 37. Howard is exactly right. Yaakov steals the blessings. Yaakov steals the blessings from his brother Esau, right? His father wants to bless. His father wants to, Yitzchak wants to bless his children. He wants to bless Esau. Rivka says to Yaakov, this can't be. Come, I'll put on fur on your hands and you go in and pretend to be your brother. How old were they, these twin brothers? In their 60s.
Oh, wow.
old. No, it's not old.
One last thing.
You're going to be a friend of mine.
One last thing, and then we'll go. Please look at the figure on page 22. Here you have a small example, a small clipping of what the text looks like in the Torah. Even if you don't read Hebrew, can you make out words? Yeah, I mean, there's spaces between words, right? Is there punctuation? No. So there's no way to break up sentences. Is there an end of a paragraph?
Yeah.
Yes, apparently. Okay. According to Jewish tradition, we know the words of the Torah. We have a tradition that tells us where sentences begin and end. And by looking at the text, we know where paragraphs begin and end. And you'll notice that there's two different kinds of end of paragraph. The first one, which we're calling Petucha, is an end of paragraph that goes all the way to the end of the line. The next one, which we are calling Stuma, is an end of paragraph, but the next paragraph starts on the same line. Right? Simple system. But that's so we know what the words are, we know what the sentences are, we know what the paragraphs are. What's missing? Well, from the text, punctuation is missing, vowels are missing. But when somebody says, Rabbi, I read in Genesis chapter 13, verse
numbers.
There's no chapters.
Mm.
There are words, there are sentences, and there are paragraphs. There are no chapters. But nowhere in our tradition do we have chapters. And indeed, this Torah, which is 3,331 years old, was given chapters about 500 years ago by Christians. Maybe 600 years ago. By Christians. And the breakup of the chapters is not necessarily in line with our tradition of how stories begin and end, and so on. It's confusing. And yet, every Jewish book all has it broken up into chapters. More or less the same way as the Christians. Why? Well, first of all, it became necessary when, in the dark times of the Jewish people in Europe, we were forced to participate in debates with the Catholic Church. And when the priests were yelling chapter and verse, the other side, the rabbis, had to respond and use the same system. Slowly but surely, it sort of trickled into our text, and it stuck. So, we borrow the system. Look at text 13 on page 23. Rabbi Yitzchak Abarbanel in the 1400s writes, I decided to divide each book into sections, read sections as chapters. However, they will not be very long, nor will they be very short chapters, like the chapters of the scholar Hieronymus, who translated the Holy Scriptures to the and divided the book of Joshua into 24 chapters, the book of Judges into 21 chapters, the book of Samuel into 35 chapters. So who did it first? The Christians. Who is Hieronymus? Most people think he means Jerome of the Vulgate, but it wasn't. It was done maybe 100 years earlier in the 1300s. So this is a system that comes to us from the outside, but is actually useful. And we use it. We don't necessarily learn the guidance, the breakup and so on, but it's useful and it works, so we're not automatically discarding something just because it's of non-Jewish origin. We learn from it. Right? Who said, accept the truth, no matter its source. So it's not quite the truth, but it works. New Testament? I don't know. Okay. So, what have we learned? If we walk away from today's lesson learning that A, there's a whole lot out there that we know about Judaism. You have a lot to be proud of. B, there's a whole lot out there that we thought we knew about Judaism, and now maybe we know a little more. C, a lot of what we think we know about Judaism comes to us from what we very affectionately call the Goyim. We need to know the difference. And D, this is our Torah. This is who we are. Let's enjoy it. Any questions?
If original, Hebrew is original language. What about the poor, the uneducated, and so forth, the early Jews? How did they learn the Hebrew?
The answer to that question is, there has barely, not never, but there has barely been a time in Jewish history when everybody had to know Hebrew. Being poor was not an excuse to not be educated. Everybody had to know how to read. Everybody had to know how to read the Torah. Everybody had to know how to pray. And except in some instances in Eastern Europe in the 1400s, 1500s, 1600s, and today, for very different reasons, there never was a time when the majority of Jews couldn't make out Hebrew. When women 800-900 years ago were considered uneducated, it was because they could only read, they couldn't read Hebrew, they could only read Yiddish. Uneducated things. Right? So, therefore, there are prayer books written in Yiddish and song books written in Yiddish because, right, so this, and this was actually an amazing thing that that it was imperative for everybody to know how to read. Which is why Mohammed has a Jewish secretary, and all the landowners in Eastern Europe throughout all the Middle Ages had Jewish secretaries, because except for the priests, nobody else knew how to read.
The secretaries are men?
Mm-hmm. Except in Muhammad's case, it was a woman.
Oh, really?
I believe. I looked that up. Yeah. He couldn't read or write either. He wasn't a priest.
You know, on page 19, you that word...
Max, I don't mean to interrupt, but I want to say, by the way, class dismissed. You're welcome to stay as long as you want.
No, that word, when I went to Sunday school, we read that as...
It's our frontlets.
I don't know.
Second of all, but that's a guess, because there is... How does anybody translate from any one language to any other language? The answer is, you have to know what the words mean. If you don't know what the words mean, what do? You look to some other text where it uses the same word and we try to get the context. Totafot are not used in any other context. So unless we speak the language, which is 3,000 years old, we have no way of knowing what totafot is. So frontlets is as good a guess as anybody, but it's a guess.
But this is a Jewish guess, not a Christian guess.
No,
we learned that.
Not necessarily, because remember, the first translations of the Torah were not Jewish. At least into English, were not Jewish. So, I don't know where the word frontlets comes from. And again, I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm saying it's not necessarily right. And of course, everybody knows that the tefillah do not go between your eyes. So even the translation of Bein Einecha, which literally means between your eyes, but it actually refers to the line in between your eyes on the top of your head. That's where between your eyes goes. So, see how...
No, I just was saying the way I was, you know, read the passage when I was in Sunday school.
You know what, but the early American publications, the early American Jewish publications that translated the Torah into English, essentially took the King James Version.
Wow.
Edited out all the obvious Christian stuff, and they called it Jewish.
Wow.
And like you say, sometimes you go through here, and then you go back to the Hebrew, saying that there is not a direct translation.
Correct.
We actually can make into our language.
One of my 613 U.S. citizens is
you know, at some point, the second point, so I thought you were getting it.
Why?
I broke the rabbi today when he said, I thought he was
party rest.
It was so mean.
I left out the whole section.
It's done kind of way. You know, I think he was mentioning Marcy's book.
But it was not about my bias. It was there.
I know.
There was no
relation
today. No.
Course they want us to read the last two verses of the Torah. And to see where the Torah says all of the wonders that God, that Moses performed before the eyes of all the people. That's the Torah's summation of Moses. Right? Says Rashi, what wonders did he perform before the eyes of all the people? Look at that one. In other words, according to Rashi, this is how the Torah sums up Moshe's existence. He's the guy who wrote the tablets. He didn't cure polio. He didn't. He's the guy who broke the tablet.
You go to Kiko.
The fact that the Torah tells us about him breaking the tablets and then uses that to sum up his life. What's the message about him not quitting? The message is his people are more important to him than he is. His people are more important to him than he is.
Yes.
Right? Or than his legacy is. His people are more important to him than his legacy. That's what happened with the tablets. Moshe's legacy, Moshe's whole existence is the Torah. Torah, Tziv, Alanu, Moshe, right? It's Moshe's Torah. He comes down the mountain with the Torah, sees the Jewish people unworthy of it, and instead of saying, you wicked, you, that's it, I'll keep the Torah for myself. No. He does away with the Torah. Because he feels it will benefit the Jewish people. Says God, I knew I picked the right guy. Can you imagine?
How much, Rabbi?
It depends how much you want to give. Oh, 71.
What does the Torah say about how much I should make this check out?
Yeah.
I mean, who do I make it out to?
Chabad of Alabama.
Oh, I see.
Chabad is fine. $79.
Well, I'm making out for Eileen and me. But.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Miranda. Can you imagine Benjamin Franklin coming out of that courtroom in Philadelphia, the courthouse in Philadelphia, after having spent weeks, and I don't know how long they were in there writing the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, he comes out and he says, we finally... What do you do? Never mind. That's what he was there for. That was his whole purpose. He fought his whole life for this. He went against his king and no, my people don't need it. It's not good for them. Out it goes. For Moshe to be able to look past himself, and not just to be kind, but to look past his very existence, his very purpose, his very legacy, his very gift to the world, and say, this is not good for the people. That epitomizes a leader. And I dare say your example does much the same thing. He was willing to say, it's not about me. Yep, that's right.